Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, more audio has emerged of controversial Australian broadcaster Alan Jones making misogynistic comments about Jacinda Ardern on his breakfast radio show. The chair of the Civil Aviation Authority has stepped down, and a central Auckland theatre is being renamed in honour of Dame Kerry Te Kānawa as a permanent tribute to the soprano.
I think it will be a very thrilling moment when I walk in there and suddenly it's got my name on the front there. It's just amazing.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, one of the leaders of the Ihumātau land occupation says she hopes the hikoi to Jacinda Ardern's electorate office on Thursday will encourage the Prime Minister to visit the site. Hundreds marched for 6 hours to present a petition signed by nearly 26,000 people asking Ms. Ardern to visit Ihumātau. Pania Newton is a co-founder of the Save Our Urban Landscape group that's fighting to prevent a Fletcher Building housing development at Ihumātau. She joined Corin Dan on Friday's Morning Report.
I wonder if you could just begin with addressing this rumour. Social media this morning, NewsHub have been reporting that Tainui Iwi may be in line to purchase the land off Fletcher Building. Is there any truth in that from your perspective?
I think those are all just speculations at this time. We are yet to hear any formal statement from Waikato Tainui, but we are still in the process of coming together under the umbrella of the Kingitanga to find a resolution for this whenua. But yeah, I've not heard anything, so I'm surprised myself, but yeah, we're still undergoing conversations at this time, and we are still staying on the whenua for as long as it takes to find a resolution.
Sure. Is that an option that has been discussed at the very least, Tainui? I mean, they have the resources, they're a $1 billion entity now. They perhaps do have the resources and the history and involvement to fit the bill.
I'm not too sure, but personally, I don't think it's moral or ethical. This is an issue between Māori and the Crown, and I think the Crown should be taking responsibility. And we've appreciated all the support that Tainui and the Kingitanga has shown or has displayed and done for us so far, but we are still undergoing conversations at this time.
That's interesting.
Those news reports are just speculations that were made by Crispin Mason.
Sure, yes. Yes, he has made some comments suggesting that Tainui was the, what he called sort of the obvious player to get involved here. But just from your perspective, this is interesting, you would be unhappy if Tainui, or for that matter any other iwi, stepped in here. You're adamant that it must be the Crown that resolves this.
Oh no, well at this time we're still discussing with our whānau what is the resolution that they would be happy with. But ultimately, the Crown has to take responsibility for the confiscation that happened in 1863 and then again in 2016 when they aided and abetted the sale of the land to Fletcher Building Limited.
Some may argue that has been dealt with, though, hasn't it, via subsequent treaty claims?
No, this land block has never been subject to a treaty claim. There's never been an apology. There's never been a recognition of the confiscation of 1863. And that's why, for many reasons, Māori have suffered ongoing intergenerational trauma.
Can I just be clear, though, because you have said in the past that this is about a natural landscape issue and not a treaty issue. So what is it?
This is a rare cultural heritage landscape that is in contention. It deserves its own unique process. And so, yeah, this isn't a treaty issue.
And just to be 100% clear again, you're adamant the Crown has got to take some responsibility here, and that's the important point.
Yes, whatever the resolution might be, which the whānau have to be happy with, at some stage the Crown has to take responsibility for the confiscation in 1863 and then again in 2016.
That's Pania Newton, the co-founder of the Save Our Urban Landscape group that's fighting to prevent a Fletcher Building housing development at Ihumātau, speaking on Morning Report. And the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, said Friday afternoon that she will go to Ihumātau, but not until the standoff between iwi and Fletchers is over. The Prime Minister has previously insisted a visit to Ihumātau right now would detract from efforts to reach a solution, but has not ruled out going. On Friday afternoon, she confirmed she does want to see the whenua herself and will absolutely pay a visit in the future. More audio has emerged of controversial Australian broadcaster Alan Jones making misogynistic comments about Jacinda Ardern on his breakfast radio show. Last week, Mr. Jones said Ms. Ardern is a clown and suggested the Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison should shove a sock down her throat. Now, other comments from that same segment are causing further controversy. Here's Alan Jones.
This lightweight New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, is challenging Scott Morrison over climate change. Now, I hope Scott Morrison gets tough here with a few backhanders. Hasn't got a clue, this woman.
A group of campaigners that take their name from a slur that Peter Dutton once made about a female journalist are taking aim at companies that advertise on her show, demanding they drop ties with the radio station 2GB. Corin Dan spoke to the founder and spokesperson of the group Mad Witches, Jenny Hill, about the campaign.
It seems to be going crazy. We've got 19 pulled out. We had a huge company called Chemist Warehouse pull out. So, yeah, we actually were gobsmacked. We can't believe it, how successful it's been.
And are you, as an organisation, asking advertisers to withdraw their support?
Yes, we've got about 50,000 followers on our page. We're asking them to email or call or Facebook to the advertisers that we're listing and just ask them if they want to support the kind of hate speech and misogyny that Alan Jones is saying about. I mean, he's done it to a lot of women, but the most recent one, obviously, Jacinda Ardern. So people are upset about it.
As you say, we've seen these types of comments and controversy before from Alan Jones, yet he has remained on air. Is anything likely to change this time?
We know that Macquarie Network, who employs him, is pretty rattled. They issued a statement on Saturday saying that if he transgressed again, they would terminate his contract, and they've never done anything like that before.
Alan Jones insists, I see, he has said that the comments in responding to the latest controversy around using the term backhanders, that no one in their right mind, I think he said, would expect that he actually meant that, for Scott Morrison to do that. So is he being unfairly targeted here?
No, that's completely ludicrous. Anyone who listens to the tape can see that he's saying that Scott Morrison should give Jacinda Ardern a couple of backhanders. And when he says he didn't say that or he didn't mean that, that's a, you know, classic example of gaslighting, you know, telling us that we didn't hear what we know we did hear. And that's what people like Alan Jones do, unfortunately, just twist the narrative to suit themselves.
He clearly has a lot of support, a big listenership. I see he brings in, what, $10 million in revenue Australian each year, so he obviously has a commercial following. It's going to be difficult for his employers, presumably, to ignore that.
Yes, but they have to make a commercial decision. If advertisers withdraw support from the show, then that has to be balanced against the trouble that he's causing. He's cost them a lot of money over the years in court cases and defamation payouts, so he must be wearing out his welcome.
So what happens now?
We're just going to keep going. We're not going to give up until we get some kind of a result. Or at the very least, we want a proper apology from Alan Jones to Jacinda Ardern. I mean, anything could happen. But not only have they lost 19 advertisers, but it seems extremely unlikely that any new advertisers will come in to fill those holes. So eventually that drop in revenue is probably going to bite pretty hard.
Do you think it's different this time? I mean, as opposed to previous controversies, that he may have in fact gone too far and this may be the end?
The anger and the feeling, the resolve that people have seems a lot bigger. Many millions of people this time, even people who technically would maybe have been a supporter of his, even people like that can see that you just don't talk about shoving a sock down a woman's throat or giving her a backhander. I mean, it's a bridge too far.
Jenny Hill, one of the Australian campaigners asking advertisers to cut ties with Alan Jones on the radio station 2GB. She was speaking on Thursday's Morning Report. The accused Christchurch gunman's manifesto is being republished in paperback and sold through an instant messaging app. A neo-Nazi in Ukraine is distributing the document through an online channel set up 2 days after the March 15 attacks. The manifesto has already been classified as objectionable in New Zealand, but the Prime Minister admits there's nothing authorities here can do to stop it being distributed overseas. Arnika Smith has more.
While the accused awaits his terror trial next year, his manifesto is being translated into Ukrainian and sold online. The messaging app Channel, set up 2 days after the shootings, is being run by a neo-Nazi and hosts more than 1,000 followers. It openly praises Brenton Tarrant and, since a few months ago, has been used as a platform to distribute a translated version of his manifesto. Independent Research Solutions researcher Ben Alley, who has studied the rise of the alt-right online, isn't surprised the document is being traded.
I haven't seen the manifesto redistributed a great deal on 4chan or 8chan, but there are a lot of people there who are definitely fans of the accused and so would be pretty keen to get a hold of it.
In June, the Channel's administrator told subscribers he'd found a publisher who could make copies of the manifesto. He thanked a follower for the idea to produce it as a book and encouraged those who couldn't pay for one to print their own. Since then, a series of photos of people posing with a copy have been posted in the forum. In one, a line of seven men stand holding a copy in front of them, while another captures the book next to a pair of child's hands playing with a small toy truck. The chief censor, David Shanks, who classified the manifesto as objectionable in March, says the distribution is concerning.
It's incredibly disappointing to see a platform that can be accessed by New Zealanders making available publications that are unlawful in this country.
David Shanks says the document has the potential to incite violence.
It is a terrorist promotional document. It's not going to persuade or harm most people who read it, but it's not for most people. It has been created specifically for those people who are on a pathway to radicalisation.
Ben Alley says the accused's manifesto is treated by the far right as an important document.
They take him very seriously and are very pleased with what he is accused of having done. It's not clear necessarily whether they are likely to go out and do the same things themselves or not, but they've certainly treated the attack here in Christchurch as being a component of their ideology and a result of it.
The acting head of the Islamic Women's Council, Anjum Rahman, says there's no doubt the manifesto's spread is dangerous, pointing to several mass shootings in the United States that have referenced the March 15th attacks.
Extremely disturbing because we know that has been used as motivation to take further life, and so the importance of dealing with this is very, very high.
She says it highlights the need for action like the Christchurch call, but says the government should approach Ukrainian authorities to identify those involved and shut down any far-right platforms.
We can't as a nation deal with this on our own, and that's why the work around the Christchurch call and any other work around international agreements is so important.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has condemned the sale of the manifesto but says her hands are tied.
It's more than a concern, it's abhorrent and it's disgusting. But it is being sold in a jurisdiction over which we have no control. It just demonstrates the difficulty we have now in this current environment of dealing with the spread of what we in New Zealand would consider really objectionable material.
She says the Christchurch call, a voluntary agreement to stop violent extremism and terrorist content from spreading online, will make a considerable difference, but it can't fix everything.
Annika Smith with that report from Thursday's Checkpoint program. A prominent Ngāpuhi elder says the Ombudsman's report on conditions in Ngāwhā prison is gutting for those who had high hopes for the facility. Honi Sadler says he was one of the kaumātua who were promised by the government in 2004 the new prison near Kaikohe would help Māori inmates turn their lives around. He says the report of prisoners being denied water and forced to relieve themselves in the exercise yard is like something out of medieval times. Honi Sadler says the government also promised that Ngāwhā would house Northland prisoners so whānau could visit them, and that promise has also been broken. The Minister for Corrections is Kelvin Davis. He joined Corin Dan on Thursday's Morning Report.
I'm pretty gutted with that kind of report. I'm shocked that this is happening in Ngāwhā. That prison was set up almost as a model for rehabilitating Māori, and that's not going to help people be rehabilitated.
Honi Sadler says the government also promised Ngāwhā would house Northland prisoners so whānau could visit them, and that promise has also been broken. Well, the Minister for Corrections is Calvin Davis. He joins us now. Good morning.
Kia ora.
This is all happening under your watch.
Yes, look, I welcome the Ombudsman's report, and I think it provides justification for exactly the direction that Corrections is heading in. We released Hokairangi on Monday earlier this year. We introduced the Māori pathways that are going to go through actually that very prison, Ngāwhā Prison, as well as Hawke's Bay Prison. We also announced $128 million around mental health in prisons.
Sure. So fair enough, you've got a new strategy on the way, but I've got to pull you up here, because this has all been happening under your watch. And do you accept responsibility for prisoners being forced to relieve themselves in the exercise yard?
Look, I'm told nobody is denied access to toilets, but what we've seen in the report is unacceptable. And like I say, I'm grateful for it, because it justifies exactly the direction that we're heading Corrections in terms.
You promised as the spokesperson on Corrections that things would be done differently, and yet here we are in 2019 and they haven't been.
Well, we are doing things differently. We've released our Hokairangi strategy. It's been co-designed by Māori, for Māori, as well as the Māori pathways. That's also been co-designed. I see the Ombudsman criticised the relationship with the local iwi. I'm not sure whether he means Ngāpuhi itself or Mana Whenua Ngāti Rangi.
But means Ngāti Rangi, and I can pick you up on that. And that does seem to be an issue, that their relationship had broken down with Ngāti Rangi, and that suggests that putting in your new strategy may be complicated because of potential divisions within iwi.
Well, we've been working with Ngāti Rangi. In fact, in November of last year, we called a hui with all the iwi that from Tāmaki in Auckland in the south right through to Ngāti Kuri in the north. That's 10 iwi. But we invited them to be engaged in the Māori pathways. But we said anything we do, we have to do with Ngāti Rangi's blessing as mana whenua. So we're working on that relationship. There's been a number of meetings with them. And in fact, I'm meeting with them in a week or so, because we need them on board before we do anything in that prison, when we can then bring in other iwi and we can start really deciding and defining what we're going to be doing differently. This is the whole purpose of the Māori pathways through prisons, and it's also the whole intent of Hokairangi, which we launched on Monday.
What sort of funding is Hokairangi going to get to be implemented effectively?
So because Hokairangi is the strategy for Corrections, Hokairangi is what Corrections funding is going to be used for.
So it comes out of the baseline, is that what you're saying?
So the money
that we
have...
No extra funding for this strategy.
It's because this is the new way that Corrections will be working, and so they will be using the money that they get in budgets to implement Hokairangi.
Okay, so there's no specific money, because this is interesting, because the problems identified in this report make it clear that one of the issues was staff are so busy because of double bunking and because of issues with security in the prisons, which you had promised to deal with, that they don't have time for the training when it comes to understanding Māori worldview and changing the way in which they do their practices. You're going to have to increase funding for the staff, increase staff, in order to actually roll out this program.
You understand that we inherited a system under pressure, the double bunking. I would prefer there to be no double bunking, but under the previous government, the population went up 20% over 5 years. We've managed to get that to plateau around 10,000 prisoners. If the previous government had still been in, it would be up around 12,000 now. So we're having to deal with that double bunking issue, as well as, you know, the
but
other
no
things.
New money for this strategy in order to ensure that you can have the staff, the corrections officers, because at the heart of your strategy is training corrections officers so that they treat Māori differently.
Exactly, and $98 million is going into the Māori pathways, which has been run through Ngāwhā and through Hawke's Bay Regional Correctional Facility. So there is funding there, but Hokairangi, in terms of the whole strategy for all prisons, corrections are having to look at the way that they operate.
We're just a bit short of time, but are you confident they can do that given the problems that have been identified here? Is it realistic to think that you can go through all the prisons in this country and make that change when the one prison that was supposed to be the flagship for integration with Māori hasn't worked?
That's because we are doing that now. That's what the Māori pathways and Hokairangi are about. The 31 recommendations that were made, 28 have been accepted entirely, two partially accepted, and one hasn't been accepted. So Corrections, in the 6 months since that visit was made, have already made changes to what they're doing.
Have you been to that prison recently?
Yes, I have. I've been a number of times.
The Minister for Corrections, Kelvin Davis, on Morning Report. The Chair of the Civil Aviation Authority, Nigel Gould, has stepped down. Transport Minister Phil Twyford says he told Mr. Gould the CAA was going through some big changes and it would be best to have fresh leadership at this time. He says he's thanked him for his service to the Civil Aviation Authority. Nigel Gould joined Lisa Owen on Wednesday's Checkpoint program.
Why have you gone from the Civil Aviation Board?
Oh, very simply because the Minister requested that I go.
Can you tell us a little bit about that conversation? What did he say to you?
Exactly as I just indicated. He indicated that he has a wish that I step aside, so I agreed with that and I've stepped aside.
What reasons did he give for wanting you to leave?
He gave no reasons in the conversation.
So do you feel that you've been fairly treated?
That's a leading question. I'm obviously disappointed. You know, my term should have finished in June, and as a request, I agreed to stay on for another 12 months. There are a lot of things going on within the world of aviation in New Zealand at the moment, and would have been, and I was prepared to make the time available and, you know, contribute to that. A lot of things which have potentially very wide impact, but, you know, that's not to be the case.
So you were prepared to stay on, but the Minister didn't want you?
No, well, I stayed on because I was invited to stay on for another short period of 12 months. And as he's fully entitled to, he has indicated, you know, that there's major changes coming up, and there certainly are. And he felt, therefore, I assume, it was sensible to make a change now. And that's his prerogative, and his wishes have to be responded to in the way I have.
So the statement that the Minister has put out says that he was looking for fresh leadership. What do you think he means by that?
You'll have to ask him what he means by fresh.
So was none of that explained to you?
No, the terminology used is quite correct. It was something along the lines of fresh leadership.
When did you have this conversation?
Yesterday.
And how much of a surprise was it to you?
Well, given that, you know, there's been some very inappropriate media focus on aspects within the authority, we're obviously very aware of the interest that's been placed upon us, and so alert to situations perhaps such as this, but it came as a surprise, correct.
So what do you mean inappropriate media focus on the CAA?
Well, you've seen the big meet-up that News Hub in particular have been doing over the issues of sexual harassment and bullying within the authority, as we extensively provided to them in terms of background which they didn't want to use. We have a very well-controlled program in those areas within the authority. We're very proud of what's been able to evolve over that period of at least the last 12 to 18 months. They chose, for whatever their motive, that's what I'm talking about, News Hub, to make a real meal out of what's, you know, very much a few crumbs.
Mr. Twyford was sufficiently concerned by information that was coming out from whistleblowers at CAA that he launched, an investigation into the culture there. So what responsibility do you take for concerns around the culture there?
Well, we're always prepared to support and participate in things such as that. And when he made that suggestion, we said absolutely, because in positions such as we have, you never know what you don't know. And if there is something which might be there that we have assumed not to be there, then it's good to be able to get some independent verification of it. So the program which he had indicated he wished to do some two or three weeks ago through the Ministry of Transport, we were fully engaged with and fully supportive of, and quite willing to see what might come out of it.
You questioned the motivations of people, whistleblowers, who came forward to raise concerns about bullying, alleged sexual harassment at CAA. Is that why you're going?
Absolutely not correct. What we were questioning was the motives as to why they would not use the existing channels, which were very clearly defined within all our staff policy documents, and not follow those procedures, right through to the opportunity to talk to me or the Secretary of Transport in full confidence, without any issues. I questioned with News Hub in particular, and I've got full copies of the transcript available to me. I questioned of them why these people would choose to go down that channel then there's very clearly prescribed opportunities they have to talk in full confidence within the authority.
Is making those comments publicly, do you think, part of the reason that Phil Twyford has asked you to step down?
I can't make any comment about what his motive was.
So have you left the building as such? Is that it? Or
you're asking, am I in Wellington at the CIA office? I'm certainly not there now, no.
Okay, so was it your involvement terminated immediately, in essence?
Sorry, I didn't catch that. Can you repeat that?
Was your involvement with the CIA terminated, in essence, immediately following this conversation with Phil Twyford?
No, we have to go through a transition. There's some delegated authorities and responsibilities, et cetera, that need to be passed on. And I've talked to them about how that will be undertaken in a very orderly and certainly, from my point of view, a very cooperative stance. My responsibility and interest in ensuring that the authority is not adversely impacted, potentially or otherwise, by my change.
We are almost out of time. Is anything you've done, are you partly responsible for the minister asking you to step down? Your behaviour, anything you've done?
I've got no knowledge of any reason why there should be anything else, no.
The former chair of the Civil Aviation Authority, Nigel Gould, who has stepped down, speaking on Checkpoint. The Mayor of Auckland, Phil Goff, has announced his bid for re-election on a platform of tackling climate change and protecting the Auckland environment. He's pitting himself against former Labour colleague John Tumahiri in what he's describing as an election of starkly contrasting values. Phil Goff joined Corin Dann on Monday's Morning Report.
What do you mean by different values?
I think that it's quite clear that I'm looking for the future. I'm looking for how you deal with congestion, because you've got to improve your public transport system. You've got to improve your walkways, your cycleways, how you plan your city, making sure you create jobs around the new housing estates, which we're doing in Drury and Warkworth. I'm not talking about building 18-lane harbour bridges, including for trains, when there's no train lines at either end of the bridge. So there's quite a lot of difference there. I'm focusing on infrastructure, I'm focusing on environment, I'm focusing on an inclusive city, all three of those things.
Let's pick you up on this because John Tamahiri's been criticised for his big visionary plan on the bridge. What about your plan of barging 250 cars at a time away from the port? That's been called into question as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, curious that Michael Barnett should have done that, because the chief executive of the port says that he's quite enthusiastic about the idea, and there is a player in the game that says that they can do that economically, and they are the player that takes 80% of the use.
Just read to you from Todd Nile, of course, who's been covering council politics for many years. He says in a column that there was a letter in May from the port to the council on the issue of the barging. It said it is unlikely that anything more than marginal improvements would be economic. Apart from the question of economics, barging is physically only possible to Highbrook, and goes on to question whether the vehicle industry or the new vehicle industry would want to do it.
Well, let's get it absolutely clear. The chief executive of the ports, I talked to him about this, obviously, before I made the announcement, because I'm not in the business of making fantasy announcements and dishonest announcements. He said, no, this is something that should and must be investigated, and he was described as being enthusiastic about it. The company that's interested in doing it absolutely believes that it's viable, and of course, if you can barge cars off the wharf, you can clear the wharfs more quickly, but you can also remove truckload after truckload of imported cars from clogging up the central city area and the motorway. Nothing fantasy about
that. All right, okay, so just to be clear, if you are re-elected,
an 18-line harbour bridge,
if you are re-elected, we will see barges with 250 motor vehicles, new car or new imported cars, leaving the port, what, on a weekly basis?
Oh, it'd be more than a weekly basis, of course. Those ships bringing the cars in are coming in a couple of times a week. That's what the investigation is about. I've done enough work to know that there is a sound business case that can be made, but now we're doing the proper investigation, and it will be done properly. And if that investigation shows what I believe it shows, then that's exactly what we'll be doing, and we'll be doing it not within the 10 to 15 years that my Michael Barnett was talking about, we'd want to do that quite quickly.
Okay. One of the big issues seems to be in Auckland around wastewater, the beaches, the swimmability. You're saying that you are making faster progress, but how will you realistically be able to pay the billions of dollars that are required to upgrade Auckland's ageing water infrastructure? How will you pay for that?
Well, it's all budgeted, and it's budgeted through... we started a week ago the commencement of construction on the Central Interceptor, which is a $1.4 billion massive pipeline that goes from Grey Lynn all the way through to Mangere, necessary for increased growth, but necessary to stop those sewage overflows onto our beaches that happens every time that it
so
rains.
So when will you be able to say that there won't be a big rain and suddenly you can't go down and swim at Point Chief?
I made that quite clear, that within this decade, we will have stopped 90% of those overflows 20 years ahead of the program that Council had laid out at the time I became Mayor. That's a significant achievement.
Well, of course, because John Tamahere is arguing that he would sell half of Watercare. That would give him a lot of money, potentially $5 billion in order to do that process. He's also, of course, talking about selling some of the port operations.
Yeah,
so he would have a lot more money in the kitty to be able to deal with these infrastructure problems than you would.
Yeah, well, let's deal with that. First of all, Ports of Auckland. While the future of the ports and its longevity of its presence in the centre of the city is in doubt, and there's a major government report into whether it should be moved, you don't have a saleable port operation. So that's just a nonsense. And by the way, I believe the ports should move when we find an alternative and viable place for them to go to, and we'll keep the land and we'll use the land for the benefit of Auckland. Secondly, on Watercare, if you sell half the value of Watercare, which is probably about $5 billion, that would automatically put every Auckland household's water rates annually up by $200 to $300 a year. And that, of course, will hit hardest those with more children and those that are low
income. Fair enough. So what's the counterfactual there, though? So what are you having to borrow because you're not selling half of Watercare? Where are you raising the money?
I mean, we're raising the money through the areas that we traditionally do, such as government co-payments and through rates. But we've kept our rates lower than any of the big and medium-sized cities anywhere in the country. We're looking at things like special purpose vehicles, and we're experimenting with that.
Hang on, so special purpose vehicles, so that you can borrow off the council balance sheet? Because at the moment you can't borrow, can you?
No, that's right. Because we have got a commitment to being prudential. We've got the second highest credit rating of any organisation in New Zealand after government.
But correct me if I'm wrong, you're pretty much at the limit, though, aren't you, for big infrastructure?
Yeah, and that was the situation I inherited, and that's the situation that will continue to go on. So we're looking at special purpose vehicles, and the government is looking at legislating to facilitate that.
So what, you just take the debt and put it on some other...
No, what happens is that if you can bring the infrastructure forward, such as up in Milldale, where we brought the infrastructure forward maybe by 10 years, those properties can be sold cheaper than what they would have been if we'd waited that period of time. People get access to them earlier, but people do have an encumbrance on their title, which is to pay for the cost of
it
that.
It sounds like a bit of an accounting mechanism, when really, isn't John Tamahere at least being honest by saying,
no,
you've maxed out the
no,
council
he's been
debt, and you need to sell something.
He's being totally dishonest, and you only have to read Simon Wilson's article in the Herald this morning, and that sets out, it goes through thoroughly what the council's books look like, and it quotes one of my councillors, Desley Simpson, who's obviously got very strong National Party connections, and she points out absolutely clearly that we have made progress on value for money, that we are managing our finances absolutely responsibly. The auditor, the Office of Auditor General will tell you that. The independent people I've put in charge of our Audit and Risk Committee, some of our most skilled auditors, our accountancy people.
You made your point, fair enough.
We'll tell you that.
You made your point.
It's totally dishonest to talk about.
You have made your point. What it does sound, Mr. Gough, is that you're potentially a little bit rattled here, that John Tamahere is in with a chance to win this.
I'm not rattled at all. What I say is that I take any election seriously. I've fought a few of them now. I will be running on my track record, which is of honesty, which is of trustworthiness, which is of integrity.
Yeah, but do you think he can beat you?
Experience. That's up to the people of Auckland. Anything can happen in an election, and it depends how many people turn out and which people turn out. And what I'm doing is encouraging my supporters, come from across the political spectrum, to get out and vote to secure the future of Auckland.
Are you polling? Do you have polling data that suggests it's close?
I polled originally, and it showed quite a large margin in favour of myself. Other candidates have dropped out. Their votes will be redistributed. I haven't got any current polling that says where it's at, but what I'm saying is I'm not complacent about it. I'm taking it seriously. We'll go out to fight to win, and we will win, but we are not taking that for granted, and nor should Aucklanders.
The Mayor of Auckland, Phil Goff, on Morning Report. A record number of candidates have put their name forward to contest for Dunedin's mayoralty. 14 hope to fill the void left by three-term incumbent Dave Cull, who's stepping aside. Here's our Otago Southland reporter Timothy Brown.
Traditionally, changes to Dunedin's leadership have marked a seismic shift or the ascension of an heir apparent. But the current Dunedin mayor, Dave Cull, says this time the race is wide open.
I won't go into my preferences now, but I think there are people in there capable of picking up the role and growing into it. So I'm optimistic that we'll get a positive outcome.
Not since 1989, when a schism within the Citizens Association led to Richard Walls ignoring the candidacy of Michael Haggett and grabbing the chains himself, has the race been so unpredictable. The smart money is on a trio of incumbent councillors, Christine Garry, Aaron Hawkins and Jim O'Malley, but it's another councillor, one who's came second or third in the past four elections, who believes he's the frontrunner. Lee Vandevis says he would have toppled Dave Cull if he hadn't stepped down.
I'm the only councillor guaranteed to get back on the council because I had double the vote of virtually every other councillor at the last election. We've had lacklustre leadership and we need now to move with the times.
During recent trieniums, the Dunedin City Council has embarked on a set of policies and plans which have brought climate change into focus. The forthcoming election may act as a referendum on those decisions and, to a wider extent, the future of such action in the city. But Dave Cull pays short shrift to those who take issue with the recent direction.
I don't have much patience with the idea that because there's a view held it should be represented on council. If that were the case, we'd have the Flat Earth Society in there. And that's about the level of debate that some of those people bring to this. My feeling is that the community in general appreciates the need. I mean, for goodness sake, we've got the biggest urban area at risk from sea level rise in the country. If Dunedinites don't appreciate the problems of climate change, then there's no hope.
Mr. Vandevis has opposed many of the moves and says councils have been more invested in virtue signalling rather than putting their money where their mouth is to address climate change. And climate change has also piqued the interest of many rookies. Malcolm Moncrief-Spittle doesn't appreciate the classification of alt-right, but he's a Donald Trump supporter and self-described climate sceptic.
I think our media in New Zealand is particularly bad at giving the sceptics a fair hearing. So I think as a council, we shouldn't have declared a climate emergency. And even on the national level, I think we should withdraw from the Paris Agreement.
At the other end of the spectrum is Generation Zero activist, 27-year-old Finn Campbell.
Too long. Young people, when we try and engage with politics, we have to sit outside the door of decision makers, policy makers, legislators, and kind of politely ask for things to be done. And I kind of went, you know what, bugger that. I stand a real good chance of coming up with some equally as valid ideas that really capture the youth perspective on council.
There are only 8 weeks until the elections, and who will wear the mayoral chains is anyone's guess.
Timothy Brown with that report from Monday's Morning Report. And a diverse range of Kiwis are contesting next month's local body elections, with some saying they're frustrated with who's making decisions over their lives. In the current crop of elected members, the vast majority are Pākehā, older and male. But a new generation appears to be rising up in pursuit of the reins of power. Jordan Bond reports.
There are more elected members over 70 years old than there are under 40. 90% are Pākehā and 62% are men. But there's a new generation of politically active people who want change. Running in Wellington is Terry O'Neill. She's 21, a renter, catches the bus every day, and is a member of the LGBTQI community. She wouldn't be your typical city councillor.
And our generation has sort of grown up with a whole lot more economic insecurity and insecurity around housing and rental laws and campaigning for mental health funding. We've kind of seen those issues bubbling. Agency and that urgency has really kind of pushed us pretty hard, and we're all getting to that age where we want to be taken seriously when we talk about these things.
One person who hasn't seen anyone like themselves in politics is Scout Barbara Evans, who's running for the wide-open Dunedin mayoralty. They're takatāpui, non-binary, so not male or female, a part of the population that's not represented in politics at all.
Realistically speaking, we don't have a single non-binary councillor anywhere in the country. We don't have a single non-binary DHB representative, no one on the liquor boards, no one in Parliament. And for a surprisingly decent chunk of New Zealand's population, it really is a gender equality issue.
Tim Young is 31 and running for a seat on the Hamilton City Council. He has a Masters of Science and is tetraplegic. He has almost no movement from the neck down. Mr. Young says his vision for Hamilton's future is to prepare for disruptive technologies, for artificial intelligence, and to transition to green technologies to counter climate change. He says those technologies need to be deployed to help a growing, ageing and disabled population.
59% of those over the age of 65 are disabled, and that segment of the population is growing from 15% currently to 30% over the next 30 or 40 years. And so I'm trying to convince the current councillors that they need someone like me on there preparing for their future.
Climate change comes up repeatedly when talking to young, aspiring politicians. Louise Hutt, the 26-year-old CEO of a social enterprise, says it's a threat to her generation's future. She's running for Hamilton Mayor and City Council and mentions the school strike for climate as an inspiration.
A lot of concern about what our future, like, literally looks like. What are the opportunities that are going to be available to us? Because the blueprint that past generations have had for the rest of their life might not exist for us anymore, and that's quite scary.
Rabia Anayatullah is 21 and is half Fijian Indian and half Pakistani and is running for Porirua City Council. She says young people have proven themselves as political leaders out in the streets but don't have the representation around council tables.
Young people are leading at the moment with things like climate change. Like all the rallies that you see in Parliament, there's always young people that are backing this. I think that we are already leading today, but like having young people at that decision-making level, it's so crucial because it is our future.
A tally for next month's elections counted at least 80 people under 40 vying for election. But young people typically aren't voting. Less than 40% turned out last election, compared to more than 80% of those at retirement age. But these candidates are hoping that will change once their peers see people from their own generation listed on the ballot papers.
Jordan Bond with that report from Monday's Checkpoint program. The last two people charged after the massive 90 Mile Beach methamphetamine bust in 2016 were sentenced Wednesday to lengthy prison terms. Stevie Narua Cullen and Selaima Fakasila appeared in the High Court in Whangarei on Wednesday before Justice Gordon. Lois Williams was there and filed this for Checkpoint.
In June 2016, Kaitaia police, acting on a tip-off, found nearly half a tonne of meth in a camper van and stashed in the sandhills near Ahipara. Sceptical locals have been watching a group of men driving flash cars, trying to launch a boat, damaging it, and then heering off to Auckland to buy another one worth $90,000. They claimed they were burying a friend's ashes at sea. The two Asian men in the group eventually made the pickup from a boat waiting offshore. Six people are already in prison after admitting their roles in the country's biggest ever meth haul. But Cullen and Fakaosilea denied the charges of importing Class A drugs and being part of an organised criminal group. They were convicted after a jury trial in June. At their sentencing today, their lawyers suggested the pair had played relatively minor roles compared to the major players, including two Tongan men and two from Hong Kong. But Justice Gordon was having none of it. She said Cullen had been a trusted lieutenant and chauffeur who organised boats, cars and motels for the group. And Fakaosilea, who'd been painted at her trial as a Tonga blonde, was no naive pawn, as her counsel claimed. Instead, she'd played an important role in handling communications and large amounts of cash.
Once it was apparent that an alternative means of landing the methamphetamine was required, the purchase of a boat was necessary. Members of the Northland Group travelled to Auckland for that purpose. I have determined on the evidence that you were the person, Blaze, who provided the money for the boat. That indicates a high level of trust in you. You were not the naive pawn.
A cultural report done for the court claimed Cullen had returned home to Hawke's Bay, hoping to set up a vineyard on whānau land, but couldn't raise the finance, and succumbed to the offer of making some fast cash by helping to import methamphetamine. He believed his problems in raising the money were down to the colour of his skin. The Crown lawyer, Richard Annandale, rejected that.
There are a great number of successful Māori people in our population and in our community. To claim, as the report writer seems to do, that Mr. Cullen was at a disadvantage because of his Māori ethnicity would, in my submission using the Court of Appeal citation I've just referred to, appear to some a proposition that is offensive.
Justice Gordon sentenced Cullen to 27 years with a minimum period of 9 years in prison, and she sentenced Whakaao Selea to 12 years and 6 months on top of the 14-year prison sentence previously handed down for dealing in meth and cocaine. She'll have to serve at least 7 years behind bars.
That's our Northland reporter Lois Williams with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint programme. The blame game was in full swing in Parliament on Wednesday, with MPs accusing those on the other side of being responsible for high petrol prices. A Commerce Commission report on Tuesday confirmed Kiwis pay too much for petrol, with the fuel industry not as competitive as it should be. The government has vowed to act, but the opposition wants to know how. Here's our Deputy Political Editor, Craig McCulloch.
Our instinct was that New Zealanders were being fleeced at the pump. Now the Commerce Commission has confirmed that it is true.
The Prime Minister in Parliament claiming vindication and vowing to act.
I note that the last government could have acted but decided it wasn't easy and decided to do nothing. It seems to me that was their general philosophy in government.
The retort setting a fire under the opposition early in question time, with National's Paula Bennett accusing the government of doing the fleecing.
Will the Prime Minister then continue to ignore that it's the increases in taxes that she has put on everyday New Zealanders that she could take off tomorrow if she really cared about the cost of living for them?
Seriously, if they weren't being hypocritical on the use of excise.
By the end of its 3-year term, the government will have put up petrol taxes by 10.5 cents, not including the 11.5 cent regional fuel tax in Auckland. When National was in charge, it put up taxes by 17 cents, but over a much longer 9-year period. But National also increased GST from 12.5% to 15%.
We will not ignore that New Zealanders are being fleeced. We will not write a sternly worded letter. If required, we will change the law, because that is what an active government who is not willing to ignore the hard issues does.
But the promises of action are drawing scepticism from the opposition benches, with constant cries, "Tell us what you'll do."
Can the Prime Minister outline actually what she will be doing to the petrol fuel companies, since it won't be just writing a letter and she's at the moment got such strong convictions about how she's going to stop them from fleecing New Zealanders?
Oh, Mr Speaker, again, the member demonstrating that she would prefer to defend the fuel companies on this issue.
So far, potential solutions floated include allowing wider access to infrastructure and boosting competition by allowing resellers to switch between suppliers. The Commerce Commission is due to finalise its report and recommendations in early December. For now, the government's all promises. Only then will the public see what it means in practice.
Our Deputy Political Editor, Craig McCulloch, with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint programme. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, advocates for tenants are worried new guidelines for landlords won't stop them asking potential tenants dodgy questions. And if you want to stand at the dead centre of New Zealand, there are now two options.
Well, we're very happy to share.
Oh, look, if they want to claim it as well, that's absolutely fine. It's a fantastic country, so we can share the love.
Still to come in The Week in Review. An expert on alcohol-related harm says there's no point in submitting on a review of the code that governs how drinks companies can advertise their products. So far, 60 organisations and people have signed their name to the boycott, including the Health Coalition, Cancer Society and Alcohol Action Aotearoa. Morning Report producer Jeremy Wilkinson has more from Thursday's programme.
There are many times you'll find yourself enjoying New Zealand's number one Kentucky bourbon and cola,
But is it okay if your mate's mum gives you a woody?
It was 1987 and New Zealand was going off. But there was a problem. Wine was in and beer was out. While men pretended to enjoy wine, they never forgot about beer.
The alcohol industry in New Zealand has become almost synonymous with humorous advertising over the years, but alcohol harm experts aren't finding anything funny about how it's sold to consumers. The Alcohol Advertising and Promotion Code is up for another review, and many of the country's leading agencies advocating for tobacco and alcohol harm reduction won't be making a submission. Sally Caswell from Health Coalition Aotearoa says there's no point in submitting to the review.
The code, as it stands, is not worth the paper it's written on because it doesn't make any real changes to what the industry wants to do. So we need to develop legislation. There are plenty of good examples around the world. We do this with tobacco. We don't have tobacco sponsoring sports. We don't have tobacco being marketed.
She says New Zealand needs to move to a regulated system which reduces exposure to alcohol marketing instead of lifestyle advertising that uses humour to glamorise a brand. In 2010, the Law Commission made 153 recommendations for reducing the harmful effects of alcohol in society, with most of the key points failing to be implemented by the national government. Then in 2014, a ministerial review found that raising the price by as little as $1 per standard drink would reduce alcohol harm. The code is voluntary, and Caswell says that works in the industry's favour to ward off more strict regulation.
They use it to say, we are doing something about this situation, we are acting like responsible citizens, and the reality is very different.
She says the Advertising Standards Authority is made up of members of the alcohol broadcasting and advertising industry and is not in a good position to seriously analyse complaints, and that the government needs to step in. However, Chief Executive of the Authority, Hilary Souter, says Caswell is mischaracterising the entire process.
There are certainly not people who represent alcohol advertisers in the room when the decisions are made on alcohol advertisements. We have a very strong conflict of interest policy. But regardless of that, the Complaints Board is a 9-member board, 5 public members who don't have industry connections, and 4 industry members who represent advertisers, agencies, non-broadcast media and broadcast media, because actually they have a really useful perspective and are very knowledgeable in what you can and can't do in relation to advertising.
The total number of complaints received by the ASA last year was 820. Of those, 4% were alcohol-related and 16 of those were upheld. Ms Souter says no contact was made with the ASA before Caswell called for a boycott of the review in the New Zealand Medical Journal.
We specifically went out to a range of these organisations, gave them the consultation paper and invited them to comment, and they've chosen not to. I'm not sure it would be very productive in the last sort of 3 days before the deadline of the closing date for me to have a further discussion with them. They've nailed their colours to the mast pretty clearly.
Submissions for the review close tomorrow, and the new draft code is available on the Advertising Standards Authority's website.
Jeremy Wilkinson with that report from Morning Report. Universities and polytechnics hope to end decades-long disparities in Māori and Pacifica students' pass rates in just a few years by copying big companies like Amazon. The Tertiary Education Commission says the techniques used by tech-driven firms to track customers can be applied by tertiary institutes to identify students who are at risk of failing. It says that's how Georgia State University in the US completely eliminated ethnic disparities in just 9 years, and New Zealand institutions could do the same. Our education correspondent John Gerritsen has more from Tuesday's Morning Report.
Pass rates for Māori and Pacifica students are as much as 20 percentage points lower than for other groups. It's a long-standing national problem that's resisted multiple attempts to solve it, but the Commission wants to eradicate it in just 5 years. Tim Rennick from Georgia State University in Atlanta has been in New Zealand telling tertiary institutions that it can be done. He told RNZ white students at his institute were 40% more likely to graduate than African Americans 15 years ago, but now there's no difference at all.
What we've been able to do over a relatively short period of time, about a decade, is turn those numbers on their ear. So we have no equity gaps any longer. For each of the last 4 years, our African American students, as well as our Hispanic and our low-income students, have all graduated at or above the rate of the whole student body.
Dr. Rennick says a big part of the university's approach is the sort of data analysis usually associated with companies like Amazon.
We're tracking every student for 800 different risk factors every day. And if we see any problem, instead of letting it get worse, now we're proactively reaching out to the student and say, you know, you took your first quiz and you're a STEM major and didn't do well in your first math quiz. Let's see if we can get you some help before the next exam, instead of just sitting back and waiting for what was almost inevitable to happen.
Tim Rennick says the university's better able to help struggling students, and he's sure the approach can be applied in New Zealand. Waikato Institute of Technology is in the first stages of adopting a similar model. Its acting chief executive, David Christensen, says it's using student data to spot who's likely to drop out and when.
So it starts at the beginning, really, with a whole lot of predictive analytics over applications from what types of students and what are the attrition points, and using IT to alert us when triggers for students. Maybe they haven't handed in some work, maybe they haven't appeared in class for a little while, following it up, getting alongside them to say, hey, you know, what's going on? What can we help?
David Christensen's not sure WinTech will eliminate disparities by 2022, but he's confident it will make a big difference in the next few years. Paura Amundsen from the Tertiary Education Commission wants more tertiary institutions to follow WinTech's lead. He says they need to start responding to warning signs like a low mark in a student's first assignment.
We can see in the data globally that people who get a C in the first year have a much lower achievement in the next years out. It doesn't cost much for universities and polytechnics to say, hey mate, you need a little bit of extra help, you know, with your law study group or your calculus or whatever the heck it is. So there's little things right across the board.
Paura Amundsen says Georgia State's experience proves long-standing disparities can be eliminated.
That report from our education correspondent John Gerritsen from Morning Report. A district health board in one of the country's poorest areas is worried it could lose funding because of the serious problems with the latest census. Our health correspondent Karen Brown filed this for Wednesday's Morning Report.
Gisborne-based Tairawhiti DHB serves 50,000 people, more than half of them Māori, and with a high level of deprivation. Like many others, the DHB is in deficit and expecting to end this financial year in the red to the tune of $12 million. Accurate census data matters to the DHB because the information helps determine some of its funding under what's known as the population-based funding formula. The DHB's chief executive, Jim Green, says census data is vital to this process.
It's very, very important because the funding way in which we're funded as DHBs is based on the populations that we serve and the dynamics of those populations. So factors such as the proportion of Māori and Pacific people within our populations are important parts of the funding formula because of the way in which it works. So we need to have a really good degree of accuracy around how that is so that we make sure that the funding is devolved in the right way across the country.
He hasn't seen any results for the 2018 census yet, but when he gets it, he'll be cross-checking the details with GP groups, including primary health organisations or PHOs.
We're expecting to get that soon, and then they will be able to start off our analysis ourselves so that we can see what it looks like compared to where we think we are, what the projections were from the last census that were used in the current funding round, and what other data we've got, like our PHO enrolment data.
Mr Green says potential for inaccurate information in the census is a concern.
Our population is the most deprived and needing of health services in the country, and if this has got in the way of us having the resources to be able to work with the people and provide the care they need, then that's very significant for us, and we need to do all that we can to make sure that that is not disadvantaging people in our population.
The chair of a group representing all DHB chief executives, Catherine Cook, says Statistics New Zealand has bolstered the census data with other administrative data, and DHBs have been reassured it will be accurate.
That does remain to be seen to a certain point, but we have been reassured that this data will be of sufficient standard to, you know, drive the population-based funding formula. We clearly haven't seen that yet, so are not in a position to judge for ourselves, but that's the reassurance that we've had.
She adds DHBs have been told the lack of input into the census by Māori is being addressed.
We have been reassured that particularly for Māori and Pacific people, that additional data has provided a level of assurance to stats about the full data set that will then flow to the Ministry of Health.
National's health spokesman Michael Woodhouse says he believes health is the sector that will be most affected by what he labels the census debacle.
My concern is that this is going to make things much, much worse, and it's going to be hard for DHBs to justify the sorts of financial allocations that they're going to get from the ministry.
He adds he worries that DHBs, all but one of which expect to end the year in deficit, will give up trying to achieve financial viability. The Health Ministry says the new census data will be included in the 2021-22 planning round, adding it's working closely with Statistics New Zealand regarding use of the data in health.
That report from our health correspondent Karen Brown on Morning Report. The government wants to be able to direct councils to free up planning rules to allow cities to grow both out and up in a bid to solve the housing crisis. The Urban Development Minister Phil Twyford and Environment Minister David Parker unveiled the proposed new strategy at a housing development in Porirua on Wednesday morning, and they're confident their plan will be able to reassure even the most sceptical NIMBY. Yvette McCullough was at the announcement and filed this for Wednesday's Checkpoint program.
CARIS Executive Chairman Sir Paul Adams says the Resource Management Act and overly restrictive planning rules are hindering development. He says it played a role in slowing down the 800 home development in Kinapuru, Porirua.
But that really cost us about a year and a lot of money in terms of planning, which is really just a waste at the end of the day and gets passed on to the end purchaser, obviously.
Phil Twyford says under the government's proposal, councils, particularly in the six high growth areas, will be given a clear direction to loosen their rules.
It tells councils that they must make room for growth. They must free up the planning rules in the cities, in the urban core and around transport corridors. They must lift the height and density restrictions that currently stop people building the kinds of homes that they want.
Councils will also have to take a long-term approach to urban planning that brings together transport, housing and infrastructure. Mr Twyford says the focus will be on high-quality development that avoids the pitfalls of sprawl.
It's possible to create high and medium-density communities with quality urban design and provision for open spaces that will reassure the most sceptical NIMBY.
David Parker is reassuring this won't mean cities are overrun by high-rise apartments. He says this plan will help shift the attitudes of councils and ratepayers concerned about intensification.
I think most people accept that when you've got the number of people who are sleeping on the streets that we see in some of our main centres, something's got to change. And you can't change things without changing things.
The government says it has broad support from councils for this plan. Porirua Mayor Mike Tana is a fan.
This, I think, is a great response to ensure that we're all connected up, local government, central government, and the developers as well. This is an enabler.
Auckland Mayor Phil Goff has welcomed the move, but has cautioned against planning for growth without having the funding to go with it. He says there needs to be some degree of revenue sharing between central and local government, a sentiment echoed by Tauranga Mayor Greg Brownless.
We need a significant investment by government in the transport networks to service that housing. I'd also like to see government look at ways of helping councils fund the cost of growth.
The government says it won't be giving councils extra funding to carry out their planning duties, but it is looking at ways to help with funding and financing infrastructure. But National's urban development spokesperson Judith Collins says the strategy is full of flowery words that don't mean much. She says it's a stopgap for proper RMA reform, reform that she says won't be forthcoming.
Well, the RMA is going to remain in its current form for some time, and that's primarily because there's no way that the Green Party and the New Zealand First Party are going to agree together on the same issues around RMA reform.
Consultation on the government's proposal is open until October 10th, with the strategy likely to take effect in the first half of next year.
Yvette McCullough with that report from Checkpoint. Advocates for tenants are worried new guidelines for landlords won't stop them asking potential tenants dodgy questions. The Privacy Commissioner, John Edwards, has released guidelines about what landlords can and cannot ask potential renters. Manawatū Tenants Union Coordinator Ben Smith told Corin Dan on Tuesday's Morning Report, tenants aren't always in a position to say no.
Why do you think they're not in that position? There's a pretty clear guideline there. Is it just a power imbalance?
Absolutely. I mean, these new guidelines are great, but if you can just imagine for a second, it's not uncommon to see tenants now competing for a property. They might be one out of 30, 40, even 50 tenants applying for that house. Are they going to risk their chances at getting a roof over their head for a bit of their privacy? It's a appalling situation that many tenants are faced with, but it's not uncommon. And until we address the housing crisis and we actually have the government taking proactive steps to address what are the questions that landlords and property managers are asking, we're going to keep on running into these issues of tenants not having the ability to say no.
And in your experience, are tenants being asked things that they shouldn't be, such as their marital status, their personal beliefs, their nationality, this sort of thing?
All the time. I mean, for one, we're asking for details of employment. Employment status is extremely common, and that's something that a lot of landlords discriminate against, looking down at people just because they may not be in employment at the moment or because of their background. Recently, I was thinking I was talking to a tenant who was asked extremely intrusive questions by their property manager around, or by a potential landlord, around their relationship status, how stable their relationship was. And quite frankly, it's just unacceptable. It's none of a landlord's business. The tenant's relationships, the guidelines are clear, but tenants are not in a position to say no. Quite often.
There might be some, though, who question whether it's not unreasonable for a landlord to ask about employment history, given that paying the rent is something that they would be reasonably concerned about.
Well, certainly. And look, we say tenants will generally not be applying for a property unless they're able to pay the rent, but they need somewhere to go. We know that discrimination on the basis of employment status is unlawful, and that's something that landlords should be mindful of when they are selecting tenants. It shouldn't matter whether a tenant is in work or out of work. They still should have a right to the roof over their head just the same.
Are there things that should be on the list of banned questions, in your view, that aren't there?
We've really just started going through the list. I think they're a good start. And, I mean, when you have that alongside the Human Rights Act, that gives a pretty good basis for what landlords should or should not be asking and what tenants should be comfortable handing over. I think it's a fairly reasonable guideline myself.
That's Manawatū Tenants Union Coordinator Ben Smith on Morning Report. The builders of high-rise apartments in central Wellington resisted getting translations done of key Chinese quality control documents. Emails show the Wellington City Council dropped its demand for a translation after the steel supplier complained about the cost, but then the council changed its mind. Phil Pennington filed this for Morning Report.
The 20-storey, 114 apartment block at 111 Dixon Street is almost finished, though it's still waiting for code compliance sign-off from the council. That won't happen until the council sees the certification that backs up the independent testing of the structural steel imported from China. The council's been faced with wading through a mass of quality assurance, or QA, documents. The project director, Rob Noble, of 111 Dixon Contracts, in February this year, writes,
"It is fair to say that there is a mountain of information."
The emails newly released to RNZ under the OIA show Mr. Noble and the council agree that instead of the council checking all the documents, they'll ask the project's engineer for a comprehensive statement that he has checked them and is satisfied. But the council wants something else as well.
In relation to the information in the QA not written in English, can you have this translated by an independent translator and verified by an affidavit?
On April the 17th, Rob Noble replies,
"The translation you suggest can be done, but given the volume of documentation, this would be quite a task and no doubt expensive. As a suggestion, what if we simply had the Chinese redacted from the documents?"
But blanking out the Chinese text won't be countenanced by the council team leader of operations, Matthew Hodgkinson.
"I've spoken with my management team and we would like the documents translated into English, as this information is critical to us forming reasonable grounds for compliance. Removing the information in Chinese would be altering the original documents. By having the documents translated by an independent translator and verified by an affidavit ensures that there is a complete and full translation of the document. I appreciate this is a big task, but we have to be able to interpret the information we receive."
Rob Noble alerts the steel supplier, a small Palmerston North company, Pinnacle Rigging, led by Cameron Easton. In late May, Mr. Easton emails the council,
"The translation of QA document for the Dixon is proving to be a lengthy and costly exercise, with costs estimated to exceed $20,000, costs which we had not allowed for. Is there a more cost-effective approach that meets your requirements? As a suggestion, Pinnacle Rigging could provide a signed covering letter that would state that Pinnacle Rigging agrees that Wellington City Council accepts no responsibility for any items written in Chinese text, or words to that effect. Your earliest reply would be much appreciated.
3 hours later, Matthew Hodgkinson comes back.
I have spoken to the lawyers at council and we agree that a statement from you covering the sourcing of the steel will be sufficient. Also, to answer your question about the translation, this is no longer required.
The project director at 111 Dixon, Rob Noble, was not aware the emails had been released to RNZ until we spoke to him on Monday. He says all the quality assurance documents were in both Chinese and English to start with, and it seems that when the council understood this, it realised its demand was silly. However, he could not explain why the emails don't mention this at all. The developer, Mike Cole, in early July, told RNZ there has been a rigorous sign-off procedure. Just this week, Mr. Cole says it was made clear to Rob Noble that cost wasn't an issue. If we needed to get the documents translated, we would have, he said. The council told RNZ that Pinnacle Rigging's covering statement about the source of the steel has been okayed by an independent engineer. The council has not responded to questions about why it didn't ensure the testing regime was good enough before the apartment tower was built, rather than wait till it's already up.
Phil Pennington with that report from Wednesday's Morning Report. The council now says the contents of the Chinese documents remains one of the topics of discussion with the developer. This change in position is not reflected in any of the emails released under the OIA or in any of RNZ's communications with the council prior to 5 a.m. on Tuesday morning. RNZ asked the council for evidence that translating the quality control documents had remained a live issue, but has not provided any. The council reiterates it is collectively satisfied with the design and construction of the building. A central Auckland theatre is being renamed in honour of Dame Kiri Te Kanua as a permanent tribute to the soprano. Aotea Centre's ASB Theatre will become Kiri Te Kanua Theatre on November the 20th. Dame Kiri will be the guest of honour at a gala concert to celebrate the theatre's new name. Zoe George filed this for Thursday's Morning Report.
Dame Kiri says she couldn't believe it when the name change was first mentioned. But speaking from England, she says it's a great acknowledgement of the art form she's dedicated her life to.
When someone mentioned it, I said, what? This is impossible. But how very, very wonderful it is, and a tribute to music and the classical music and everything, and performing arts, wonderful.
Dame Kiri says the renaming is not just about her, though.
I think it will be a very thrilling moment when I walk in there and suddenly it's got my name on the front there. It's just amazing. But it's not about me. It's about music. It's about what we've all worked for so much. The foundation, all the people in New Zealand who have promoted young singers, all those people who have established small festivals, everyone's helped. It's just amazing.
The name change was driven by the Kiri Te Kanua Foundation, a foundation that supports the next generation of opera singers. The name change is to acknowledge the work Dame Kiri has done on the world stage and to mark her 75th birthday. Foundation Deputy Chair Diana Fenwick says the foundation worked on the name change for 2 years and took the request to change the name to current sponsors ASB, who embraced the suggestion.
Well, I think it's an accolade which is long deserved, and if you look around the world, it's not uncommon to have theatres named after people who have made an immense contribution to the genre that they have been involved with.
New Zealand Opera's General Director Thomas de Mallet Burgess says to have a theatre named after an opera singer means a lot for the art form.
Grand theatre, grand gesture, grand dame. It sends a signal that the arts are important, and a signal that one particular person's career is recognised and celebrated.
The APO's Ronan Tai says it's a great honour to perform at the gala concert.
Oh, it's a really exciting opportunity for us to basically pay tribute to one of the great sopranos of the world, but also one of New Zealand's most important cultural ambassadors. So obviously we're thrilled and very excited about it.
The full lineup of performers for the Name Unveiling Gala will be announced early next month.
Zoe George with that report from Morning Report. Forest and Bird is warning an increase in yellow-eyed penguins getting caught in fishing nets is pushing the nationally endangered bird to the brink of extinction. It estimates 30 of the penguins were caught in commercial nets last year at the bottom of the South Island and on the mainland's east coast. Here's our fisheries reporter, Conan Young.
Just 10 years ago, there were 600 nests counted in the mainland population of Hoiho, which are one of the rarest penguins in the world. That's now down to 227, thanks in part to the impact of disease and possibly climate change. Forest and Bird's Kevin Haig says some commercial fishing nets are also a known threat.
The fishing method that's implicated here is set net fishing. It's one of the crudest mechanisms that we have for catching fish because basically the set net will catch everything that's in the water column.
Kevin Haig says the reason the death count from last year is an estimate is that most fishers are failing to report when they pull up birds in their nets. He says it's no coincidence the three penguins that were reported last year happened to be on boats with observers on board, noting that only 10% of boats in this region carry observers.
We fully expect that the number is a lot closer to 30 and potentially even more, of course. The industry cannot be trusted to self-police, and that we desperately need cameras on all fishing boats.
Forest and Bird also wants a complete ban on set nets in all areas where the penguins forage for food.
Is the stark choice. Do we value this species enough to make changes to the places and the way that we fish? Or do we say the cost of making the transition in some way is too great and therefore we're prepared to see this species become extinct from the mainland on our watch?
The industry group Fisheries Inshore was approached for comment but was not available. In a statement, it says Forest and Bird is scaremongering and questions the way it's estimated the 30 deaths. It says starvation, disease, predation by sharks and dogs are the real reasons numbers are declining. But penguin expert Professor John Cockrum backs Forest and Bird's estimate of deaths attributable to nets.
Indeed, it's a very clear and threat, and we can't directly address natural threats, but we can directly address the human threats.
The government is consulting on options to stop Hoiho numbers from falling any further. Professor Cockrum says while its proposal talks about the threats posed by nets, it doesn't suggest a fix, and this isn't good enough.
The Hoiho is a threatened species, its numbers are declining, and here we have one of the reasons for the decline, and that a reason that doesn't need to be there. So a ban on set netting is an action that would be beneficial.
The Minister of Conservation, Eugenie Sage, says she's discussing with officials whether more money is needed to help keep the penguins safe or if more emphasis needs to be put on reducing marine threats. She says nets are a threat to Hoiho. All eyes are now on her department to see if it will come up with a plan that works, or if we're looking at a future where the Hoiho will be seen on the $5 bill and nowhere else.
Our fisheries reporter Conan Young with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint program. And finally, in the Week in Review, if you want to stand at the dead centre of New Zealand, there are now two options, the traditional one in Nelson and a new one in Wairarapa. GNS Science says Nelson needn't worry about losing its popular landmark on Botanical Hill because it still marks the centre of the 4% of New Zealand that's above water. Our Nelson reporter Tracy Neal explains.
Nelson is proud of its centre of New Zealand status, but a few months ago it gained a rival. A plaque was placed deep in the Tararua Ranges marking a United Nations decree New Zealand is part of a large undersea continent. A GNS marine geologist, Cornel Durand, says the plaque is the new centre of the above ground and the underwater New Zealand.
Some time ago, the United Nations said, if you can prove that you have a continent that goes beyond the 200 nautical miles, then you can claim that as well. And so New Zealand did that, and this is in effect the centre of that entire landmass.
The plaque is about 11 kilometres from Greytown. Mayor Viv Napier says while the town has a solid spot on the New Zealand map, it's pleased to now be on the world map.
I was just really surprised that basically New Zealand is 96% underwater with the new continental shelf, 1% of the Earth's surface. That's pretty cool for little greyhound.
And the Wairarapa, that's wrong.
I met Nelson's Deputy Mayor Paul Matheson in the Botanic Gardens, that's home to the centre of New Zealand Hill. He says the city is not about to lose its distinctive lightning rod marker at the top of the hill. Mr Matheson says there is no reason why there could not be two centres of New Zealand.
Oh, yes you can. Yeah. I mean, there's this new one. Ours has got a heap of history. I mean, where we are at the present time, this is where the first game of rugby was played in New Zealand. And there's a plaque to honour that. So oh, I suppose they want that next. But anyway.
These people walking their dogs and drinking coffee in the Nelson sunshine at the Botanical Reserve were relaxed about Nelson's new rival.
Well, we're very happy to share.
Oh, look, if they want to claim it as well, that's absolutely fine. It's a fantastic country, so we can share the love.
Oh, it's quite nice. I quite like the Wairarapa. I'm from the North Island anyway. I'm from Upper Hutchinson, just on the other side of the hills.
Tracy Alexander, who sells coffee from a cart at the reserve, was less than impressed.
That is so not cool. I thought it was measured out properly. And now what am I going to say? Come down to the park.
GNS says the project was a joint effort with NIWA, Land Information New Zealand, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Science researcher Jenny Black carried out the calculations that identified where the new centre should be. Dr. Durand says it puts a stake in the ground over how we need to see ourselves primarily as a maritime nation.
Mostly we should be looking from the shore out towards the sea, knowing that there's this huge sovereignty, if you like, owned by New Zealand. So ultimately that may relate to things energy, food, resources, whatever, but by far the largest part of New Zealand is under the water.
New Zealand-born pioneer pop and conceptual artist Billy Apple, who was intrigued by the notion of the large underwater realm, helped to create the plaque with the Department of Conservation. Viv Napier says maybe it's a good time for Greytown and Nelson to acknowledge each other's place.
Because I see that Billy Apple was the one who asked the question, and I think he's pretty cool. I like his art and stuff like that. Maybe he could come up with something.
Ms. Napier says so far her council had not done anything official to mark the event. Nelson will be watching.
That report from our Nelson reporter Tracy Neal on Tuesday's Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki, have a great week.